batteries wrapped themselves in gun smoke his spyglass couldn't penetrate. Unaware of the deadly sniper fire sizzling in on Doyle's position, or of the fact that his own guns couldn't even reach the Carizian artillery's exposed position, he had no idea of how one-sided that confrontation was turning out to be. Instead, he felt a cautious stir of optimism that the enemy wasn't having it all his own way. And that sense of optimism grew stronger as Barkhor and Mancora finally resumed their interrupted advance. The Carizians had never halted their advance, however. Or rather, they'd simply continued closing until the range had fallen to about 200 yards. Then they'd stopped, meticulously dressing their own formation, letting the Marines catch their breath, while the Coruscantians recovered from the disorganization the scout snipers had imposed. When the enemy resumed his advance, they were ready. Garvai's budding optimism vanished into icy horror when the entire Carizian line of battle vanished behind a sudden, fresh eruption of smoke. He might have been too far to the rear to realize the range at which the scout snipers had fired, but he was close enough to tell the Carizian line battalions had opened fire at least twice his own troops' maximum effective range. From the elevated advantage of the steeple, he saw the front line of his own battalions ripple, like trees in a high wind, as the deadly volley ripped through their tight formation, and all too many of them toppled before that wind's dreadful strength. They were packed so closely together that any Marine who missed his own target could be virtually certain of hitting someone else's, and the big, soft lead bullets struck like mangling hammers that shattered limbs and bodies in grotesque sprays of blood. Garvai couldn't hear the screams of the wounded, but he could almost taste his men's panic as they realized just how badly outranged they were. "My God, they're going to massacre us!" The thought ripped through his mind as a second, equally massive volley of rifle fire crashed out from the Carizians. It wasn't quite as deadly as the first one, but that was only because the previous volley's smoke prevented the Marines from seeing their targets as clearly. And it was deadly enough. Still more Coruscantians went down, and Garvai's front began to waver. Hector Bonnier, the Earl of Mancora, watched in disbelief as the rifle fire smashed into his lead regiment's battalions. Reorganizing around the loss of so many junior officers had been bad enough. Now this. He clenched his jaw, his mind working furiously as he sought some answer to the looming catastrophe he already saw rumbling down upon his wing of Garvai's army. It was deliberate, he realized. The pinpoint removal of so many company commanders, so many standard-bearers, had been intended to make a point as well as to ravage his command structure. The Carizians had been telling him, telling all of his men, that their marksmen could pick and hit individual targets at preposterous ranges. Now they were making the even more devastating point that even their line units could fire at those same insane ranges. And however they were doing it, it wasn't with any sort of rifle Mancora or any other Coruscantian had ever heard of. It couldn't be a rifle, not with the deadly speed with which volley followed upon volley. The bastards were actually firing faster than any of his own flintlock-equipped musketeers could have. Yet at the same time, those had to be rifles, because no unrifled musket could possibly have so much range. He felt his own nerve wavering as the implications hammered home. All of the priests' fiery rhetoric, their condemnation of the apostate Carizian heretics, came back to him in that moment. To be honest, he'd never really believed the wild tales about Carizian heresy, about the way they'd opened the doors to Shan Wei and her dark temptations. But now, as that impossible weight of fire mowed down his men, he wondered. No, There was nothing demonic, no violation of the prescriptions in the new Carisian artillery. He didn't know how they'd managed what they were doing to him now, but he told himself that it had to be something else, like the new artillery mountings. Some cunning new trick, yes, but something any mortal man could have devised. Which did nothing at all to rescue his command. He glared at the rising wall of smoke above the Carisian firing line, then drew a deep breath.
"Sound the charge! Now!" he barked.
Brigadier Clarake heard the Coruscantian bugles. They were faint and distant through the wailing of his own bagpipes and the crash and thunder of artillery and massive rifle volleys, but he recognized them, and he nodded in ungrudging understanding.
"Whoever that is in command over there, he's quick," the brigadier thought. "Not quick enough, probably, but quick."
The two sides were a little more than 200 yards apart. Advancing at the double, infantry would require at least 2 minutes to cross that gap, and it was most unlikely the Coruscantians could hold together for 2 minutes under his brigade's rapid, massed fire. Each rifleman was firing approximately once every 15 seconds, and he had 1,500 of them in his two-deep firing line. In the 2 minutes it would take the enemy to reach them, those 1,500 men would fire 12,000 rounds at no more than 5,000 targets. The opposing commander couldn't know that, though. If he'd had time to think about it, time to analyze the weight of fire ripping through his men, to truly grasp the rapidity of that fire as well as its accuracy and range, he almost certainly wouldn't have tried it. But he didn't know. Hadn't had that time, which meant, under the circumstances, that he'd put his finger on the only slim chance he had, or ought to have had, for victory. A stand-up firefight between his musketeers and Clarake's riflemen could have only one ending. But if he could charge, get to grips with his greater total number of men, he might still carry the field.
"Only that isn't going to happen," Clarake thought grimly.
Garvey grasped Mancora's thinking as rapidly as Brigadier Clarake had. Unlike Mancora, however, he wasn't trapped in the very forefront of the disaster sweeping over his army like some inrushing tidal wave. He didn't have to make the decision in the midst of bloodshed, carnage, screaming wounded, blinding waves of gun smoke, and the smell of shed blood and riven and torn bodies. He never blamed Mancora for a moment, knew he would probably have made the same choice in the Earl's position. And he knew it was the wrong one. Barkor, on the other hand, showed no sign of launching any charges. For what Garvey was privately certain were all the wrong reasons, Barkor was doing the right thing, while Mancora, for all the right reasons, was about to make a disastrous mistake.
"Signal Baron Barkor,"
he snapped over his shoulder, never taking his eyes from the field before him.
"Instruct him to begin falling back immediately."
"Yes, sir,"
one of his aides blurted, and Garvey heard boots thundering across the planking as the young man dashed for the signal station.
Of course, with all this smoke, the odds are no better than even that Barkor will even see the semaphore, Garvey thought bitterly. On the other hand, he's cautious enough he may turn tail and run on his own any minute now.
It was already far too late to stop Mancora, but it was possible he might still salvage at least the majority of Barkor's men if he could only withdraw them from the perfect killing ground he'd provided for the Carisian rifles. The realization that he was the one who'd chosen exactly the right terrain for the Carisians' new tactics filled him like poison, and the fact that he actually wanted one of his subordinate commanders to be gutless enough to run away from the enemy was bitter as gall. Yet it was also true, and his face set like congealing stone as Mancora's infantry advanced into the dreadful maelstrom of the Carisians' fire.
"Why?"
The thought went through his brain. Why are you doing this, God? We aren't the schismatics trying to tear your church apart, they are. So why are you letting a good man, a good commander, take his troops into a meat grinder like this one, while a cretin like Barkor won't even advance? There was no answer. He knew there wouldn't be one, and his eyes were hard as he realized he'd actually be forced to commend Barkor after this battle, assuming God and the archangels weren't merciful enough to get the Baron killed, rather than stripping him of his command as his timidity so justly deserved. Earl Mancora's infantry hurled themselves forward. How the handful of survivors from the winnowed ruin of his forward ranks managed to advance instead of running away in terror or simply flinging themselves to the ground was more than the Earl was prepared to say. But somehow they did it, and his heart wept within him at the gallantry with which they responded to the bugles. They moved forward, stumbling over the bodies of dead and wounded comrades. They waded into the smoke, forged ahead into the storm front of rifle fire, like men leaning into a hard wind, and the meaty thuds and slapping sounds of heavy caliber bullets ripping through human flesh were like hail. The Carizians watched them come, and even the men killing them recognized the courage it took to keep advancing. Yet courage was not enough in the face of such a totally unanticipated tactical disadvantage. It wasn't Garvai's fault, wasn't Mancora's. It was no one's fault, and that changed nothing. Almost 800 half-inch bullets slammed into them every 15 seconds, and they were only flesh, only blood. The advancing Coruscantian battalions were like a child's sandcastle in a rising tide. They melted away, shredded, broken, shedding dead and wounded with every stride. They marched straight into a fiery wasteland like the vestibule of hell itself, roofed with smoke and fury, filled with the stink of blood, the thunder of the Carizian rifles, and the shriek of their own wounded. And it was more than mortal men could stand. The men of the leading battalions didn't break, not really. There weren't enough of them left to break. Instead, they simply died. The battalions behind them were marginally more fortunate. They realized that all the courage in the universe couldn't carry them across that beaten zone of fire. It simply couldn't be done, and they did break. "Yes!" Clarake shouted as the Coruscantian formation disintegrated. Pikemen dropped their cumbersome weapons, musketeers discarded their muskets, men threw away anything which might slow them as they turned and ran. A harsh baying cheer of triumph went up from the marine rifleman, and yet, in its own way, that wolf-like howl was almost a salute to the courage of the Coruscantians who had marched into that furnace.
"Sound the advance!" Clarake commanded.
"Aye, sir,"
Colonel Johnston acknowledged, and 3rd Brigade swung into motion once more. Charles Doyle swore savagely as Mancora's wing came apart. He understood exactly what had happened, not that understanding changed anything. He'd still just lost the infantry covering the right flank of his beleaguered Grand Battery, and it wouldn't be very long before the Carizian left swung in on his own exposed right. The range at which they dismantled Mancora's infantry told him what would happen when their massed volleys joined the blasts of grapeshot and pinpoint sniper fire already tearing into his men. But if he pulled back, if he tried to get his guns out, then Barkor's right would be uncovered as well. And if the Carizian left could advance fast enough, they might actually reach the highway bridge before Barkor. If they managed that, trapped Barkor between themselves and their advancing fellows. Doyle's jaw clenched so tightly his teeth ached as he watched Barkor's wing falling back with alacrity. He had no more doubt than Garvai about why Barkor was doing what he was,
Yet, whatever the man's reasoning, it was the right thing. He was still going to lose heavily to the Carizian's fire, but his retreat was the only thing that might get half of Garvai's advance guard out of this disaster reasonably intact. And if that meant sacrificing Doyle's 35 guns and 600 men to save 5,000, it would still be a bargain at the price. Besides, he thought with a sort of ghoulish humor, I've already lost so many dragons and horses I couldn't get more than half of the battery out of here anyway. His heart ached at what he was about to demand of the men he'd trained and led, yet he drew a deep breath and turned to the commander of his right flank battery. The major who had commanded that battery half an hour ago was dead. The captain who'd been his executive officer up until 10 minutes ago was wounded. Command of the entire battery had devolved onto the shoulders of a lieutenant who couldn't have been more than 20 years old. The young man's face was white and set under its coating grime of powder smoke, but he met Doyle's eyes steadily. "Swing your battery to cover our flank, Lieutenant," Doyle said, and forced himself to smile. "It looks like we're going to get a bit lonely." April, Year of God, 893. 1. The Temple and Madame Angelique's, City of Zion, the Temple Lands. The side conversations in the Grand Council Chamber were more hushed than usual this year. The chamber itself had been meticulously prepared for the afternoon's ceremony. Ancient tradition said the Archangel Langhorne himself had sat in council with his fellows in this very chamber, and its magnificent wall mosaics and the enormous, beautifully detailed map of the world, 4 times a man's height, inlaid into one wall, certainly supported the tradition. Portraits of past grand vicars hung down another wall, and the floor, paved in imperishable, mystically sealed lapis lazuli, like the floor of the temple sanctuary itself, was covered with priceless carpets from Harchong, Desner, and Sodar. An entire army of servants had spent the past 5 days dusting, mopping, polishing, honing the chamber's normal magnificence to the very pinnacle of splendor. The glittering crowd of vicars seated in the chamber's luxuriously comfortable chairs made a fitting match for the enormous room in which they had gathered. Jewels glinted and flashed, bullion embroidery gleamed, and priests' caps glittered with gems. The air in the chamber circulated smoothly, soundlessly, warmed to exactly the proper temperature by the temple's mystic wonders, despite the snow falling outside the temple annex in which this treasure box of a meeting room was housed. Perfect, softly glowing illumination poured down from the chamber's lofty ceiling, lighting every detail of priceless artwork and sumptuous clothing. A long buffet table of delicacies stretched across the short end of the chamber, although short was a purely relative term in such an enormous room, and servants circulated with bottles of wine, ensuring that the vicar's glasses did not suffer a sudden drought. Despite the comfort, despite the splendor which underscored the majesty and power of God's church, a curiously fragile tension hovered in the chamber's atmosphere. Voices were lowered, in some cases almost to the level of whispers, and some of the wine glasses required more frequent replenishment than usual. Zomsen Trenaire sat in his own chair, the one reserved for the Chancellor of the Council of Vicars, located just to the right of the Grand Vicar's empty, elevated throne. Jaspar Clinton's chair flanked the throne from the other side. Each had chatted easily with the members of his staff, making the occasional small joke, showing his calm assurance, but after exchanging a single smiling nod of greeting, the two of them had made a point of not speaking to one another since they'd taken their seats. Rumors of their recent disagreement had filtered throughout the temple's hierarchy. No one knew precisely what it had been about, although a great many people suspected that it had owed something to the explosive news from Farade. The totally unprecedented findings of the Farade Tribunal certainly suggested that it had, at any rate. Even the most jaded temple insiders had been astonished by the tribunal's conclusions, and the penance Clinton had been assigned by the Chancellor, speaking for the Grand Vicar, had been equally unheard of. Clinton had accepted his penance with every outward sign of humility, humbling himself before the high altar, leading memorial masses for the innocents who had been slain along with the obvious heretics in Farade. He had even performed his 5-day of service, laboring in the temple kitchens to feed his far humbler brethren, serving plates with his own 2 well-manicured hands. However humble he might have chosen to appear, no one believed for a moment that he had enjoyed the experience, and there were persistent rumors that he held Trinaire personally responsible for his humiliation. Needless to say, neither Trinaire nor Clinton had confirmed any such thing. Indeed, they'd both taken considerable pains to establish that whatever their confrontation had been about, it had constituted, at worst, a temporary rift between them. Of course, some of the temple insiders would suspect that their obvious rapprochement was all a mask, a disguise to prevent their many enemies on the Council of Vicars from scenting blood. Showing just the right degree of friendliness and cooperation to warn any potential enemies that an attempt to exploit any division among the ranks of the Group of Four would be unwise was a delicate task, and never more than today. Too much or too effusive a display of friendship would transmit the wrong message just as surely as too cold and formal an attitude. Especially today, it would never have done for either of them to have seemed as if he might be suffering some sort of last-minute attack of nerves, after all.
Theater, Trinaire thought. It's all theater. I wonder if there's a single man in this chamber who couldn't have earned his living on the stage if he hadn't been born to be elevated to the orange.
There were other differences between this year's address from the throne and those of years past. Normally, there would have been a standing crowd of junior archbishops and senior bishops behind the seated vicars. In theory, the members of that crowd would have been selected randomly in reflection of the universal equality of the priesthood's members. In fact, of course, invitations to the address from the throne were carefully considered tokens of power for the vicars and of prestige and influence among the recipients. This year, however, there was not a single bishop nor any member of the laity present. Even some of the more junior archbishops had been excluded, and the senior archbishops were virtually silent in the presence of their superiors.
Maybe it's not all theater, after all, Trinaire thought more somberly. Not this year, at any rate.
A single musical chime echoed suddenly, and the hushed conversation stilled abruptly. That, too, was unusual. Normally, at least some of those side conversations would have continued even through the address itself. After all, every vicar would have already received his copy of the text. Some of them might not have bothered to read it yet, but it would have been waiting for them in their offices when they got around to it. Besides, everyone would already have known what was in it, even if he hadn't received a copy. Today was very different, however. No one had yet seen the text of this year's address, no one outside of the Grand Vicar, Trinaire, the other 3 members of the Group of Four, and the Chancellor's most trusted aides, at least. And the rumors concerning its probable content had swirled throughout the ranks of the vicarate like a spring riptide, as one report after another
underscored the challenge the kingdom of Carus had thrown into the church's very teeth. Word of the marriage between Caleb of Carus and Charlion of Chisholm had reached the temple only 3 5 days before, hard on the heels of word of what had happened at Ferade, and the news had shaken the vicarate to its core. The fact that news of the marriage and the creation of this new Empire of Carus had taken so long to reach Zion, even allowing for the winter weather, was only one more sign of the threat to the church's power. The chains of temple couriers who would normally have carried that word across the cauldron to the semaphore stations, winter gales or no winter gales, had been broken for the first time in the history of Safehold. And the messages from the bishops and senior priests, whose correspondence would have announced and analyzed the event, had never been written, for the men who now held those offices were loyal not to Zion and the temple, but to Caleb and Charlion. That would have been sobering enough. The realization that Chisholm had voluntarily joined Carus in its defiance of Mother Church had gone beyond sobering to frightening, and the execution of 16 consecrated priests had hit even harder in many ways. Even those who had held quietly to the belief that the Group of Four's heavy-handed mismanagement had driven the Carisian crisis had found themselves confronting the emergence of a brand new empire, which, in the fullness of time, must inevitably take its place among the great kingdoms and realms of Safehold. An empire solidified not by simple conquest or mere dynastic marriage, but upon the common foundation of its defiance of church authority. A defiance it had underscored with brutal finality in Ferade, and one which had already added the princedom of Emerald to its territories and would certainly move upon the League of Coruscant within 5 days or months, if it had not already. 2 years ago, no member of the Council of Vicars could even have imagined a world in which such a political and religious grotesquerie could have existed. Now, all of them found themselves face to face with the hideous specter of a schism which not only had not been crushed, but was actively growing, spreading steadily from the initial source of corruption in Telesburg. In a world so much of whose certainty had crumbled, the Grand Vicar's annual address loomed with enormous importance, and all eyes and heads turned quickly towards the Grand Vicar's throne as that single chiming bell announced his arrival. As the Church's oldest traditions required, Grand Vicar Eric the 17th, the secular and temporal head of the Church of God Awaiting, God and the Archangel Langhorne's steward on Safehold, entered the Grand Council chamber alone and unattended. In this room, on this day, he was officially only one more vicar, come to report to his brother vicars on the state of God's church throughout Safehold. If the nature of his entry proclaimed his equality, however, the glittering crown upon his head, the magnificent robes of state, which, with their weight of pearls, gems, and fine embroidery, weighed more than most suits of armor, proclaimed a very different message. They underscored the absolute power which lay in the hand of the master of the church which was mistress of all the world. Eric certainly looked the part of a proper grand vicar, Trinair thought sardonically. He was a tall man, with broad shoulders, hair which had silvered with the passing years, and the judicious assistance of the Grand Vicar's valet and hairdresser, piercing eyes, a powerful arched nose, and a high and noble brow. Fortunately for Trinair's purposes, the man inside that impressively regal appearance understood the realities of temple politics, at least well enough to take direction properly. Now the Grand Vicar proceeded to his throne through the hushed silence. He seated himself upon it, looking out across the rows of vicars and archbishops, and his expression was calm.
despite the fact that every member of his audience knew his expression was a part of the carefully scripted theater they were all here to observe. Many of them actually found themselves relaxing, at least slightly, as they beheld it. Trenaire observed their reaction with satisfaction. Eric's ability to project that air of reasoned, calm assurance was, after all, one of the primary reasons Trenaire had selected him for elevation to the Grand Vicarate.
"Dear brothers in God," the Grand Vicar said after a moment, "we welcome you. And we thank you for the godly brotherhood in which we have all gathered, that we might report to you the state of God's church and work among the millions upon millions of souls committed to our pastoral care by the all-powerful hands of God and his servant Langhorne."
His voice was another reason Trenaire had selected him. It was a deep, magnificent, velvety bass that reached out to its listeners with the assurance that here was a man who knew what he was about, was as confident internally as his expression proclaimed externally. That impression was further reinforced by his ability to memorize lengthy speeches, like the address, and deliver them sincerely, passionately, and without so much as glancing at notes or a script. If Eric had possessed the force of intellect to match his other qualifications for the Grand Vicarate, he would have been a man to be feared, and Zomson Trenaire would have sought a different puppet.
"Much has transpired in the past year," the Grand Vicar continued gravely, delivering the lines Trenaire had composed for him with measured, earnest sobriety. "Much of that has been good, redounding to the glory of God and the salvation of his faithful. Yet, as all of us are aware, we have also found ourselves confronted, as no previous Grand Vicar or Vicarate since the days of Langhorne himself, by Shan Wei's open challenge in this world. The Dark Mother of Evil has thrust her finger once again into the perfection of God's work, once more seeking to mar and subvert all which is good into the service of evil."
One or two of the vicars appeared to stiffen, and Trenaire concealed a mordant smile behind his own carefully schooled expression. Obviously, at least some of the vicarate's members had continued to hope this could all just be made to go away. Precisely what might have inspired them to cling to such a futile hope was more than the Chancellor would have ventured to say. No doubt some of them, the name of Samuel Wilson came to mind, had clung to the belief that some sort of compromise might still have been patched up between the Church of Caris and the legitimate Church of God awaiting. Well, it was time to knock that notion on the head once and for all, assuming the Faraid Tribunal hadn't already done for it.
"All of us," Eric continued, "are only too well aware of the events which have transpired in Caris and now in Chisholm. We have heard the pretexts upon which the schismatics have based their apostasy, their defiance of Mother Church's legitimate, God-given authority over the souls and spiritual well-being of all of God's children. We've heard their lies, recognized their distortions, and more recently we have seen evidence of their willingness to resort even to the bloody-handed murder of God's own priests, to take into their own secular, unsanctified hands the consecrated judgment of God's priesthood, which the Holy Writ has reserved solely for the office of Inquisition and Council of Vicars, acting with all due deliberation and under the guidance of God himself and the archangels."
He paused, surveying his audience solemnly, then continued in that same level voice.
"All of those crimes, those perversions, are sufficiently dreadful to fill any godly soul with horror and repugnance. Yet I must tell you, my brothers, that the Office of Inquisition has amassed fresh evidence, new knowledge, which makes it plain that this schism, This defiance is part of a long and carefully nurtured conspiracy. That the baseless accusations the schismatics have leveled against Mother Church are the opening wedge not for a mere defiance of Mother Church's authority, but for a heretical rejection of the most basic and fundamental doctrines handed down to us from the archangels themselves.
Throughout the vast Grand Council chamber, faces tightened and eyes narrowed. Jaspar Clinton had seen to it that carefully crafted, fragmentary rumors about the confessions of the Carizians in the Inquisition's custody had reached the proper ears. But they'd been only fragments, deliberately fashioned to prepare the ground for the Grand Vicar's address, without giving away that address's content.
Much of what we have recently learned confirms things we have believed to be true. That belief was foremost in our mind when we took the grave step of excommunicating the schismatic leadership and placing the entire realm of Caris under the heavy burden of the interdict. Yet we have not made them public, nor shared them, even with our brothers among God's vicarate, because we found them so disturbing, so difficult to credit, that we demanded evidence. We will not share with you even now all that we have learned. To be honest, we continue to believe additional evidence must be provided before such serious charges may be publicly levied against any child of God. In the fullness of time, when that evidence is in hand and the time to deal with God's enemies has fully arrived, we will share with you, and with the entire body of God's Church, the full nature of the enemies who have arisen to dispute God's mastery of his own world. And do not be deceived, brothers. Whatever they may claim in Telesburg and Chiraeth, their ambition is nothing less than to overthrow forever Mother Church's legitimate authority as God's and the Archangel's chosen shepherd. The violence which racked the peaceful city of Ferade in August has been far surpassed by the brutal attack, devastation, and sack which the so-called Carizian Navy carried out so savagely little more than a month ago. And the murder, for such it was, of 16 of our consecrated brethren, 16 servants of Mother Church and the Office of Inquisition, was but the tip of an iceberg of murder and rapine in that unhappy city. Two-thirds of that city, two-thirds, brothers, lies in broken and burned ruins, littered with the bodies of its defenders and all too many of their wives, daughters, and children.
He shook his head gravely.
Who can look upon such actions, such savagery and destruction, without recognizing the hand of Shan Wei herself? And who but the servant of Shan Wei would use tales of the guilt of the Inquisitors of Ferade in an attempt to buttress all of their other lies and false blasphemous accusations against Mother Church? Shan Wei is crafty, my brothers, and her snares are cunning. See how they fasten upon the failures of a handful of God's priests and proclaim that all of God's priests are corrupt and fallen. How they strive to convince the foolish, the credulous, that God's Church, the hand of God himself in this world, is responsible for atrocities, for groundless persecutions, for corruption. It was with heavy heart that we reviewed the findings of the Ferade Tribunal, and we will not deceive you. We were gravely tempted to order those findings sealed, to turn away from confronting such painful things, for we already knew how the schismatics had fastened upon those sad and tragic events as a weapon against God. Yet, however tempted we might have been, we recognized that temptation itself as the work of Shan Wei. We realized that we dared not fail in any least aspect of our duties before God
And, most assuredly, not in a duty as grave and heart-wrenching as this, lest we display weakness before God's foes. And so we accepted the tribunal's finding, and thus we demonstrated who the true guardians of the Church are. We demonstrated that we would take even the allegations of schismatics seriously when there was evidence of wrongdoing on the priesthood's part, and that we would not permit impious rebellion against Mother Church's authority to prevent us from doing our duty as Langhorne steward on Safehold. Yet all of this is nothing more than the beginning. Nothing more than the attempt to set in place the lies and deceptions the schismatics will use in the fullness of time to justify their all-out assault on Mother Church, on the authority of the archangels, and upon God's own plan for the safekeeping of men's souls. Believe me, my brothers, what has happened in Delphirac is but a shadow, the merest foretaste of what they intend for Zion and the Temple lands in the fullness of time. The normally inaudible motion of the chamber's circulating air could actually be heard when the Grand Vicar paused. The men seated in their orange cassocks to listen to him might have been carved from stone, and he shook his head once more, slowly, regretfully. "Brothers, there is a reason we have chosen to deliver our yearly address only to the most senior of Mother Church's servants. We charge you to remember in your own utterances, your own discussion of what we say here today, that the enemies of God have ears in all places. The time is not yet meet for us to further alarm the members of our flock. Yet it is time we shared with you, our brothers and guardians of Mother Church, our belief that full-scale holy war lies before us." Some of the seated vicars flinched visibly, and Trenaire hoped the members of his staff who'd been briefed to watch for that exact reaction had gotten all of their names. "As we say, the time is not yet. Just as there are preparations to be made, plans to be cast, weapons to be built and forged, there is also the heavy responsibility laid upon us as God's true servants to establish once and for all, beyond any question or contradiction, the true depth and depravity of our enemies' plans and intentions before resorting to such stern and awful measures. No matter how just the war, how imperative the action, the innocent will suffer as well as the guilty, as, indeed, events in Faraid have already demonstrated so tragically. No true son or daughter of God could contemplate all the horrific consequences of such a conflict without fear and trembling, without the necessity of knowing that no other option, no other course of action lay open to them. And we do not utterly foreclose the possibility of some less drastic resolution. It is our hope, our earnest prayer, that the subjects of the rulers who have made themselves the enemies of God will recognize their responsibility to rise in righteous fury and cast off the servants of Shan Wei, who have led them into this apostasy and sin. It is for this reason that we issued our writs of excommunication and our proclamation of the interdict upon Karis, and have subsequently extended it to Chisholm and Emerald. Yet, however earnestly we may pray for that eventuality, we cannot rely upon it. It is our responsibility, as God's steward, to make timely preparation for the more drastic measures which we greatly fear have become inevitable. In the fullness of time, God will assuredly grant victory to those who strive in His most holy name. We have no doubt of that, and we know that your faith, as our own, is the unshakable rock upon which God's Church rests. That faith will not be disappointed, nor will God permit it to be dismayed. Yet dark days lie before us, my brothers.
Let none of you be misled into believing otherwise. We have been called to the sternest test mere mortals have ever faced. We stand in the place of the archangels themselves, face to face with the menace of Shan Wei, and we cannot command the Rakurai as Langhorne did. We cannot reach out our hand and smite the corruption of Karras and Chisholm with the cleansing fire of God's purifying wrath. But what we must do, we can do. We face not Shan Wei herself, as Langhorne faced her in the fullness of her own perverted divine power. We face only her servants, only those who have given their souls into her dark service, trusting her to bear them up. Yet those mistaken, lost, and accursed souls would have done well to recall that Shan Wei is the mother of lies and the mistress of betrayal. We who trust in the fidelity and the authority of God's chosen archangels have a surety and a fortress which Shan Wei can never provide. And because this is so, because we do battle in the armor of God himself, our victory is sure, for it will be his victory, and God does not suffer himself to be defeated.
The Grand Vicar paused, surveying the faces of the assembled vicars, and the Grand Council chamber was hushed and still.
The time has not yet come to openly draw Langhorne's sword, he said then, but that day draws near. And when it arrives, my brothers, when Langhorne's sword is unsheathed in the pure service of God, it will not be returned to its scabbard while even one of his foes breathes.
Despite her sitting room's warm fire, Angelic Panda shivered inside as she reread the letter on her desk. Unlike many of the letters which passed through her hands, this one was unencrypted, although there were code words and code names scattered throughout it, which would have made no sense to most readers. It was printed in neat block characters rather than handwritten, but she recognized Samuel Wilson's characteristic phrasing. She supposed there'd been no point in putting it into cipher when it had been accompanied by the complete text of the Grand Vicar's annual address from the throne. There were only so many people it could have come from, after all. She laid the single sheet back on her blotter and looked out the frosty window pane at the snow-choked streets of the city. She couldn't see it from where she sat, but she knew about the curl of smoke emerging from the roof of the shed her gardener normally used for summer storage. As was her custom, she'd made the shed available to some of Zion's poor for the winter. It was pitiful enough housing for Zion's climate, but at least she'd made sure the shed's walls were wind and weather tight, and she'd quietly arranged to keep the coal bin alongside the shed door filled. She didn't know how many temporary tenants she'd acquired this winter, but she did know that when the city snow finally cleared, at least some bodies would be found. They always were, and the greatest number were always huddled near the temple's vents, where the waste heat breathed out into the freezing cold. Her lovely mouth tightened at the thought, and anger stirred deep in her expressive eyes as she thought about Grand Vicar Eric's address and all of the condemnation showered upon the apostate heretics of Karras and Chisholm by the men who lived in the sumptuous comfort of the temple. Men immune to hunger and cold, who never gave a single thought to the pitiful poor, trying desperately to keep themselves and their families alive by crouching around the vents of their own magnificent dwelling place. She knew exactly what it was that had actually triggered her decision to join the reformists like Samuel Wilson, and it hadn't really been any one event, any one realization. Her own life, the studied rejection and denial of her own father, and the power of office which had allowed him to do it, had left her ripe for rebellion. She knew that much, admitted it freely, but there were so many ways she might have rebelled. Of course, she might also have simply disappeared, faded away into invisibility as one more cast-off bastard daughter seeking refuge in a nun's vocation. Even her adoptive parents had undoubtedly wished that she'd been able to accept that fate, although her beloved older sister had always known better. Yet the exact form that rebellion had taken had grown gradually, nurtured in the quiet stillness of her own mind and soul, as she witnessed the incredible luxury of the great church dynasties in a city supposedly dedicated solely to the service of God. In a city where starvation and exposure collected their grim tolls every winter in sight of the temple itself. That was what had opened her eyes to the truth of the church's internal corruption, moved her awareness to the casual callousness of the church as a whole, not simply of her own vile excuse for a father. However he might have abused the powers and perquisites of his own birth and office, he'd been able to do it only because the other men who ruled and perverted the church with him had allowed him to. Because so many of them had done precisely the same sorts of things, and the consequences for so many others had been so much more terrible than the ones for her. That was what had impelled her outrage, and it was her love of what the church was supposed to be which had fueled her rebellion against what it was. And now this. She looked at the transcript of the address from the throne once more, and like the man who'd written the accompanying letter, she saw only one thing. The men, and women, she thought, the ice in her eyes warming as she thought of Adderai Dinis and Charlian of Chisholm, who had dared to raise their hands openly against the corruption she'd fought in secret for so long, were to be crushed. She knew as well as any member of the Council of Vicars who had actually written that address, and she recognized the official enunciation of the Group of Four's policy.
"I don't understand why I can still feel so surprised by it," she thought. "It's been obvious it had to come to this. I suppose it's just that deep down inside, I wanted so badly to believe that it might not, after all."
Her mind turned to Adderai. She'd had only a single, carefully and circuitously delivered letter from Eraik Dinis's widow since she'd reached Karras safely. Her description of Archbishop Michael and Emperor Caleb and Empress Charlian had warmed Angelic's heart. The safety Adderai and her sons had found, the protection she'd been given, and her description of the heretics of Karras told Angelic Panda who was truly on God's side in the titanic looming contest whose storm clouds were spreading steadily through Safehold skies. She sat thinking for a moment longer, then inhaled sharply, squared her slender shoulders, and gathered up the sheets of paper on her desk once more. She jogged them neatly together, then slid them into the hidden compartment cunningly built into the desk, and her mind was busy as she considered the unsigned letter's instructions. She wondered what Wilson and the other vicars and senior clerics of his circle of reform were going to decide about the so-called Church of Karras. Judging from his direction to see to it that the transcript of the Grand Vicar's address reached Karras, they too had few illusions about who truly served God and who followed corruption. But had they gone far enough to realize consciously what their hearts had obviously recognized already? She didn't know, just as she didn't know whether or not this new empire of Karras would prove strong enough to resist the tempest gathering to sweep across it. But she did know where she stood, and she nodded slowly as she reflected upon that point. She stood, walking to the window, looking out onto the bleak winter beauty of the snow, and her brain was busy, sorting through all of the other information she'd acquired about the Council of Vicars and the Group of Four's intentions. She'd passed all of it along to Wilson and his circle, but she'd kept copies of all of it as well. She didn't know how much of it might be useful to Karis, but she didn't have to make that decision. Adirai could decide after Angelic got all of it into her hands.
Is it really that easy?
Her eyes followed a pedestrian as he slogged along, head bent against the wind, huddled deep inside his cloak.
That easy to go from agent of reform to schismatic spy?
She had no answer, but she felt confident God would understand. 2. Whitehorse Reach and Royal Palace, City of Manchir, League of Coruscant. The schooner's white sails sliced across the blue waters of Whitehorse Reach like the dorsal fins of krakens as they closed upon their prey. They flew the new flag of the Imperial Carisian Navy, but the single light galley, fleeing desperately before them, flew the green and gold banner of the Church. The three schooners had reacted to the sight of that flag much as actual krakens would have responded to blood in the water, and the leading pursuer had already cleared away her forward chaser. A puff of gray-white smoke erupted from her foredeck, and a thin plume of spray kicked up just ahead of the galley. The fleeing vessel ignored the demand to stop, and the schooner fired again. This time, it was no warning shot. The 14-pound round shot slammed into the galley's stern, and splinters flew. One of the schooner's consorts began to fire as well, and more splashes erupted around the fugitive's fragile hull. After another 15 minutes, and at least 3 more direct hits, the galley finally surrendered to the inevitable. Her sail came down, and so did the proud golden scepter of the Church of God Awaiting. It was a scene which had become unusual in the waters off the island of Coruscant, only because there was so little prey left for the Carisian Navy to pursue. In the last month, no Coruscantian flagged ship had been safe. Navy cruisers like the schooners and a few privateers, with brooms lashed to their mastheads, had swept the seas clear of Hector of Coruscant's ships. The few merchant ships still flying the Coruscantian flag huddled defensively in harbors, preferably neutral ones when they could find them, where the Carisian Navy might not send in cutting-out expeditions after them, while the ships of the Coruscantian Navy waited to defend their anchorages against the inevitable onslaught. Even as the schooners came alongside their prize, someone standing on their decks could have seen half a dozen plumes of smoke rising from the Coruscantian shore, where naval landing parties, covered by Marines, were busily burning naval stores, sawmills, warehouses, highway bridges, and anything remotely of military value all along the coast of the Duchy of Manchir. In a few places, the landing parties had found themselves facing garrisons or batteries. When that happened, they simply withdrew, confident they would soon find easier prey, or else they circled around any unsupported batteries to take them from their unprotected landward side. With the Coruscantian Navy blockaded in port, even light units could operate with impunity, and no army detachment could march fast enough and far enough to keep pace with a warship, or to intercept a landing party before it re-embarked once more. There was no way Prince Hector's troops could prevent, or even seriously inconvenience, the Carisian onslaught, and his coast bled from 100 tiny wounds every day.
"Put a stop to this piracy!"
The speaker glared at Admiral Tartarian, and the Earl reminded himself not to glare back. Not that he had any constitutional objection to letting some of the air out of this pompous windbag. Exactly what he and the other property owners, being inconvenienced by their Carisian visitors, thought Tartarian could do about their problems eluded him. On the other hand, as the commander of the Coruscantian Navy, he supposed it was inevitable that he would be the recipient of their ire.
"What I ought to do is tell them to take it up with Caleb," he thought bitingly. "Unfortunately, that's not a very practical response." "I realize the situation is bad," he said instead, addressing the entire delegation.